Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I'm your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Every week, we want to have honest conversations about what it means to be in one of the sector's least understood, yet most critical roles. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to remind everyone that my four fundraising frameworks are available to your organization. All you've got to do is go to my website, click on the toolbox, and download this free resource. Inside the toolbox, you'll find four frameworks, 1, 2, 3, 4, that will help your organization ensure that everyone understands how fundraising really works. Not quite so sure what I'm talking about, you will have a framework for distinguishing between fundraising cultures, a planning framework that ensures your fundraising efforts are responsive to the opportunities available to your organization, a campaign planning framework for any major fundraising initiative, and as if that's not enough, how about a KPI scorecard that combines my fascination with the science of expertise with your determination to raise more money? If you'd like to download this free resource, go to my website, lewisfundraising.com/toolbox. Again, that's lewisfundraising.com/toolbox. I'll also put a link in the show notes. Hi, Randy. Thanks for being on the Fundraising Talent Podcast with me today. Would you mind just introducing yourself before we jump into this conversation?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Glad to be here, Jason. Glad to talk with you. Well, I've been in the industry for about 20 years. I've been on all sides of it, mostly in annual giving, starting as a student caller when I was 19 years old and to the executive director ranks. I've worked both in the client side of things. I've worked as a nonprofit service provider with corporation. And now I'm solo. So running Zeal Giving Solutions, and that's where I'm at now. We're doing a lot of different things, and it's been an adventure so far.
Yeah, Randy. So before we jump into this hot topic, and I'm glad we're going to talk about it, we're going to have another guest on later this week. I'll introduce her name here in a few minutes. But Randy, tell me a little bit about your company and what it is you do.
Yeah, absolutely. So like I said, it's been an adventure and been fun. And as anybody that starts a new venture in consulting, you kind of adapt with your clients. And so initially, our main focus has primarily been on project management within the nonprofit sector. We saw a huge niche in just struggles that folks from the nonprofit sector haven't been involved in major IT implementations, RFPs, these types of things. And I actually helped launch a project management company back in 2008, and it was focused in the healthcare nonprofit industry within technology. And so I've been kind of a project management geek for a while. And so we actually started implementing some of that. Now, it's very hard for most clients to grasp the details of project management. So that's been a challenge, but it's been fun because there's a lot of new things. We end up teaching more than anything, and that's been great. But it's really evolved in kind of a technology and annual giving consulting company, but basically where we hit hot topics when it comes to digital and hot topics when it comes to annual giving solutions. So basically, when you have operations that they don't have the budget for an executive director, either in advancement services or in annual giving, we're able to go in and supplement some of that at a much reduced investment for them. And so far, it's just been amazing. We've seen nothing but positive results. And so it's been awesome. It's been great.
So how do you relate to like the CRM companies and the other digital companies? Where do you fit? Are you working with the client and sort of making the recommendation that they work with a particular CRM or that they buy this particular platform to transact gifts, or where do you fit in that process?
Yeah, preferably what we prefer to do is be involved in the conversation throughout the migration process with the product. So we're able to be an in-between between the vendor and the client. Most of the time, you have your AVP of Advancement Service or something if it's at an institution who will help be the project manager on the client side, and then you'll have some type of project manager on the vendor side. Well, one thing that is incredibly useful is having an intermediary that's there to help kind of lead the way that doesn't have really a horse in the race. They do because they're connected to the client, but I have an independent view. And that is incredibly valuable if the client has the budget to be able to make that investment for that individual project manager. Most of the time, what we end up doing is being there for either as a committee member on an initial RFP process, as we use our experience, my experience over the last 20 years of being involved in that for several clients, or on the back end, once they go into an implementation standpoint with a new platform, say it's a new crowdfunding platform, you know, I've been through that numerous times. And so I say, okay, here's some things that we've learned through our experience, and it helps them streamline that process and lower the risk. And so a little bit of all three of those sides.
Yeah, that's pretty fascinating. We're going to have to coordinate some time to sort of get offline at some point, because as I shared with you before we hit the record button, I'm trying to figure out what my enterprise is going to look like going forward in the future. And the idea that a project manager sort of fits into the equation and that you're finding success is very intriguing, because I think there are different, as you've heard me say before, I think there are different business models in the way that we serve clients in the nonprofit space as it continues to mature its way into the future. So Randy, you and I and one of your colleagues, Daphne Powell over at, where's she at? At Birmingham Southern.
Birmingham College. Southern.
Yeah.
Yep.
Have been sort of bantering back and forth, very, very graciously friendly banter about this narrative that's playing out at, where is this story playing out?
At Tuscaloosa, University of Alabama.
University of Alabama, which I find to be quite fascinating. I'm familiar with a story that's playing out at the University of Chicago. So for the sake of for the benefit of our listeners, why don't you tee up that story that's playing up, and let's see where you and I stand on this issue. And we're going to have Daphne on later this week, and she's going to share with me her thoughts. And shoot, we might even convene you back, both of you, on a third call. And we'll see how we can resolve some of this. So just for the sake of letting our listeners know what we're talking about, what's the story playing out?
So I guess to bring it simple, as all of these, they're super complicated. There's all these different nuances, but essentially their major donors, right now he is their top donor. His name is Hugh Culverhouse Jr. And he's a lawyer in Florida, and he does enjoy and loves Alabama, and he's invested now. He has he's got about a $30 million pledge out there to them. But essentially what's happened is, you know, he made this gift to be able to invest in the law school there. And they chose to honor him by putting his name on the building, the new law school building. Well, there have been several nuances along the way that there has been directional differences and different investments in the program that maybe haven't seen eye to eye completely. And there's just been some just distancing between that relationship. Now, that's not unusual. That happens a lot of times. But recently what's happened is there were some changes, some major, major political decisions that the state of Alabama had made around, you know, reproductive litigation rights. And he took major offense to it, and he expressed that through calling for the boycott of out-of-state students to enroll in the University of Alabama. So the University of Alabama Board of Trustees, which I had worked underneath before previously, they chose to say, well, then maybe we'll return your gift. And so they're going to be voting this week on whether or not to return his gift. And so he had some interesting, very open response to that suggestion from the Board of Trustees, but I'll bring that up a little bit later.
Yeah. And I read the article this morning. I actually read it for the second time because I knew you and I were going to be having this conversation. From the impression that I got with the two articles that I found, he's not asking for the gift back. Am I right? He doesn't actually want it. They're sort of saying, look, we're going to sort of disassociate. We're going to take your name off this building. And we're going to hand you this $20 million back. Do you think they're making the right call?
It's hard to tell. For some reason in this state, things seem to play out a little bit differently than in other states where I've worked as far as public education goes. It is the university's right if they believe that this donor doesn't represent their best interests and is detrimental to the health of the university, that they can make this call. The one thing I'm just struggling with is, and this is also the same, similar in the case of the University of Chicago, is, as you note, so many resources go into not only developing these relationships, but also executing the purpose and the intent of the gift. And it's just an immense amount of resources that we necessarily don't share with the donors, nor should we. But I think about that commitment. I think about the faculty that are being recruited because of the resources that are given. To me, that part of it is discouraging. So what I would prefer to see is some healthy dialogue between the donor and the Board of Trustees to show that they're working together to kind of meet in the middle. Unfortunately, that's easier said than done. But where my horse in the race is, I'm all about the mass appeal and the overall look that this gives. I mean, you're looking at over 500,000 constituents that the University of Alabama has. They currently have 38,000 plus enrolled students. What does that do to a culture of philanthropy as a whole? So that's what I would say. As far as their decision, it looks emotional. It looks reactionary, but it also looks like that on both sides. So I kind of danced around the question, but that's how I feel about it. And I feel passionately about that. I would love to see more of a middle ground on both sides. It's hurting both entities, in my opinion.
Yeah. So when I look at these stories, so I'll be doing a couple of presentations this summer. I'll be wrapping up in Wisconsin. I've got a series of talks that I'll be doing at Fundraising Day up in Wisconsin. And I'm going to be talking about this notion of the messy middle. When I'm working with an organization, I often characterize fundraising as sort of playing out in three lanes. The sort of the mass acquisition, new donor acquisition process, everything from Giving Tuesday to direct mail to special events sort of happens in that first lane. And then everything that we see happening here with these mega gifts and, estate planning, capital campaigns, endowments, all that sort of stuff happens in the third lane down at the closest, greatest impact, greatest experience usually for the donor. But it's this messy middle that I think the sector as a whole has essentially completely overlooked. And I look at these stories, Randy, and I tend to think, okay, who didn't do their due diligence in the messy middle of making sure that the relationship with this guy, whether their values were lined up? Obviously, the university has some different differences of opinions and stuff. But why aren't we going the distance through the messy middle? You take these initial gifts. These initial gifts can be shallow. They can be quick. They can be impulsive, but they don't have near the impact and they don't have near the long-term consequences. It seems like there's a likelihood that in some of these cases where gifts are being returned, like this one, could these institutions be guilty of essentially playing out the gift exchange at a $20 million level no differently than they would have accepted a gift on Giving Tuesday? Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It looks that way from my end as well. So, and the other thing I think is playing in here is, and I've seen it and I've experienced this, and so have you, is are we overlooking the risk of not addressing a subject? Like, here are some hard things we're going to put in the gift agreement, and we're going to agree to them in this relationship. And so it's a mutual thing going into it. Or is it, we have to hit our metrics. We need to raise money for school. And in Alabama's case, we're at the silent phase/initiation part of a capital campaign. So we need that. It's just that push and pull. And so that's the thing that I'm concerned about, that is, and I've experienced it. And honestly, I think all of us have been a part of it to a certain extent in the past. And that's that middle, right?
Yeah, it's that messy. Well, I think that's where, see, even the term, I totally get the necessity of a gift agreement, right? Totally get it.
Right.
But a gift agreement is no different than the marriage relation in a, you know, the whole idea of when you get married, you have a prenup, right?
Right, right.
Well, when you start talking about prenups, usually the conversation about a marriage relationship goes a little bit uncomfortable. You get a little uncomfortable, and in some cases it gets sour right away because you're like, okay, are we entering into a, you know, contractual arrangement here? Or is this the formation of a relationship where we share values and da 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 da? And I think, right. I think that messy middle is where the relationship is supposed to convert away from being so transactional. And it's not supposed to be characterized by contracts and heavily dependent upon agreements. And where we certainly expect, you know, I mean, relationships can go south. I totally get that. And we live in a society that has ways to remedy that. But I don't know that it should be the impulse that our first impulse when we're talking about a $20 million gift should be, okay, let's negotiate a contract. I think instead we ought to be sitting here having lunch, having lunch like many, many times and make sure we like each other, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And talk about what kind of change can we create together?
Yeah. I really want to kind of, and maybe I'm sure if we heard from our friends at the University of Alabama, they'd say, well, we had lunch with this guy a whole lot, but I tend to think that there might've been some instances and like this narrative that's playing out at, University of Chicago, which is very similar, two brothers, make a $100 million pledge. The first gift is given, payment on that pledge, $20 million. University of Chicago fails to meets the expectations. So these guys aren't even they want their $20 million back, and they're obviously not going to fulfill the remainder of the pledge because the institution's not carrying out the expectations accordingly. And, but you know, the other thing that kind of comes up, and I'm sure some of my listeners, as they're hearing you and I talk about this, Randy, is this sort of this animosity and this sort of anger and resentment towards the donor. And I don't think this is just about the donor. I think this is about the institution knowing how to formulate healthy relationships and just simply, you know, pointing our finger to the donor and saying this is all about power and control and wealth and all that sort of stuff is sort of missing the point of what really needs to happen here. What's your thoughts on that?
I completely agree. And this isn't a hit at any of my previous leadership, but something that Tom Brannon, the vice president of advancement at UAB, would always say, and it just sticks with me. I've never heard somebody in this position say that. He says, when it comes down to it, when you're working with a donor and you have a judgment call, always do the right thing. It's at the end of the day, that will, in the long run, that is the right decision. And so if there's some perverse incentive to do something one way or the other, avoid it and be risk averse and do the right thing. And that'll always stick with me. That was told to me about 6 years ago. And I just can't stop thinking about it. And it's hard. It's risky sometimes because you want to do what's going to move the chains. You know, you want to put something on the scoreboard, right? And so that comes down to that. My thing is, when it comes to that relationship and building it, what do you do when you see that first sign of, and this seems the case in both situations, where the donor wants to dig deep and micromanage a specific decision when it comes to which faculty member was selected with their funds as a named chair, which obviously the university has a major vetting process for And that's what they do best, right? Of hiring and recruiting and finding talent. And then you have a donor that digs in deep and says, what about this? Well, that first initial pushback, I think, is probably one of the most critical moments in that relationship of, okay, maybe there's something we didn't address initially, or just maybe the donor misunderstood how this was going to go down, but it doesn't matter at that point. So what do we do to continue that relationship in a productive way and not create this, what looks to be in both cases, a giant snowball? So, and that kind of links off of what you're saying. It's just initially comes down to that really good conversation. What kind of impact do we want to do together? And what is our relationship going to be in that? And how do you do that without being back to what you said, not a legal contractual relationship, but more of part of that healthy banter here, the healthy conversation, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I think this is the opportunity. So when I stand in front of, I'm routinely standing in front of fundraisers lately. And I say, you know, I'm out there trying to advocate for the frontline fundraiser because I think our opportunities in the future are extraordinary. I think institutions are going to continuously need to generate significant amounts of funds of the sort that we're talking about here. But the inability for organizations to retain talented fundraisers is becoming more and more problematic. And my guess is that some of the root cause of this is that this fella doesn't have a meaningful relationship with somebody within the institution to the point where, this guy shouldn't, even the fact that I have some qualms with the idea that his name's on the building. I don't like names on buildings just in general. But right. So what? Put their names up there. I don't care. But the fact that, you know, we've got these roles, these presidents turn over, the fundraisers turn over, the VPs are always turning over. Like who had the opportunity within the institution to discern and have the insight and the intuition to know that if we take this $20 million gift, it could go south really quick. He could take a position on some political / legal decision that the state makes, like the recent one. And we're going to want to disassociate ourselves with that. And do we as an institution have the audacity and the confidence to sort of turn away this gift and say, we can't put ourselves at risk like that? We're being, right. They're being reactive now. They look like it's like Superman coming to the table late. You know, it's like, it's like, why can't our nonprofit organizations be more, proactive and more assertive. I was having a conversation and sort of a, I was on a panel once and I said, why can't nonprofit organizations learn to host our own parties? And so instead of always wanting to be invited to the party, if you will, you know, the party of this, using this gentleman as example, we always sort of maintain this inferior posture that, causes us to sort of have to, you know, to want to be invited to the table. Consequently, we put people's names on these buildings and so forth, and we end up in these messy predicaments like that. It just seems like an inferiority complex constantly playing out everywhere we go. And yeah.
Yeah.
There's my soapbox for the day.
Well, what's interesting, and hopefully I'm not opening up a Pandora's box here, but there are so many parallels to this situation and what played out about 5 years ago when essentially the Board of Trustees and leadership at the University of Alabama, Birmingham chose to eliminate the football program based on very clear financial issues. And they made the decisions with what they had at the time. But again, it comes from this sense of, and this is my opinion, the inferiority complex. Because then you look, fast forward to donors in the community and business owners coming together to unite for UAB and for the program as a whole and also for the student body, and raises more money in essentially a semester, a spring semester, around $37 million that they had never even remotely been able to do before. So at some capacity, we were underestimating our potential. And we're looking at that situation as not knowing that we had that kind of potential. And that's underselling ourselves a little bit. And I I can't help but remember an early thing that I learned is our donors want to give to a winner. They don't want to give to it. They don't want to see that universities are, in fact, quote unquote, a charity. Yes, they'll give the impact of causes, but the university as a whole, they want to see this healthy, vibrant, impact machine, quote unquote machine, that is going to be a difference maker. And so that's one of the things I see played out here in the state of Alabama over the last 5 years. That's been interesting.
Yeah, I think it really comes down to, and it sounds like you and I are really much on the same page. We're using different language, but the ability to sort of to have that sort of to echo what you just said, to have the confidence to sort of know that the potential is there without having to sort of pander to a select few, the ability to say no. I just don't think nonprofit organizations of any sort, be they universities, hospitals, or your local animal shelter, I don't think that we've learned how to maintain this posture of sort of equality. Equality may be the wrong. We don't know how to be peers with our donors. So we're always sort of taking a handout. And even an institution of that size and magnitude can sometimes be perceived that way because we're sort of at the mercy of this fella who wrote us $20 million check. So what are we going to hear from your, I don't know your colleague, Daphne and I only know each other on social media. So what do you think we're going to hear differently from her? Or do you know her well enough to know?
I do know Daphne well enough. I had a chance to work with her in great extent at the University of Birmingham. And now, actually am doing some work with Birmingham Southern. And so I get a chance to see her over there too. And we kind of come from two different worlds. And one thing that she is just great at is looking at things from the donor perspective and also being able to fulfill on those relationship building stewardship types of things. And she is excellent at looking at it at the major gift level and at the mid level. And then I'm always been on the other side. I look at things from the mass market side of things.
Yeah.
So I think she's going to look at it from that perspective. And she also has a lot of experience with those dynamics and those relationships. So yeah, I'm very fascinated to see how she looks at this situation.
Well, Randy, I've had you for about 25 minutes, and as I shared with you earlier, we sort of lose our listeners at about that point. But what we're going to do here to sort of let everybody who's listening understand, I'm going to actually hit the when Randy and I wrap up, I'm going to actually take this file, email it over to Daphne, and she's going to listen to this, and then she's going to get on here later this week and sort of offer a response or a rebuttal or whatever she'd like to say, or just her insights. And we'll see what her thoughts are on this very big issue. I mean, it's a big deal. It's playing out in other institutions. And so, Randy, people know how to find me. I'm a relatively easy guy to find on social media. If somebody wants to reach out to you and learn about you and your company, what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, the best way is to look for me on LinkedIn. Again, I'm Randy A. Kinder, and I'm out there on LinkedIn. You can find me, connect with me, or you can visit us at zealgiving.com, and it has their social media links there as well. And we look forward to connecting with y'all.
Good. Thank you, Randy. It was great talking to you. We'll look forward to catching up with you again.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must-read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all-too-familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.